Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Have you noticed the corporate-controlled media headlines about the popularity of Satanism or the proliferation of demon-possessed people? For example, one headline reads, a 79-year-old Vatican priest says he's overwhelmed with exorcism, or the BBC article titled, Exorcism in Italy, a Job Too Scary for Young Priests, or the story titled, Satanism and Demonic Possession on the Rise, Triggering Emergency, Need More Exorcists. There's also a national movement of after-school Satan clubs that are attempting to establish local chapters at public grade schools in U.S. cities such as Atlanta, Detroit, Portland, Oregon, Tacoma, Washington, Salt Lake City, Tucson, and Los Angeles. Right now, the lurking evil clown epidemic doesn't seem too out of place. There's a long tradition of practicing sorcery, witchcraft, and worshiping the devil. Some of that timeline is distilled in returning guest Harry Hubbard's recent video. Harry Hubbard is a speed reader, and he's dug through his collection of rare books, maps, and artifacts, and produced a video titled Swimming in Practical Kabbalah. And in it, Harry looks at the books and information that contribute to Kabbalah knowledge. They include the Temana, the Azulit, the Zohar. He talks about alchemy, demons, divination, magic, and sorcery. His primary research source is the Encyclopedia Judaica. The Encyclopedia Judaica defines the Kabbalah as the traditional and most commonly used term for esoteric teachings of Judaism and for Jewish mysticism, especially the forms which is assumed in the Middle Ages from the 12th century onward. What's interesting in this two-hour presentation is the emphasis on various contradictions, such as repeated anonymity of Kabbalah source books, or the ethics in the use of magic and sorcery. The detailed descriptions of the underworld are intriguing. There are lists of angels and demons in charge of the hours and the 7 days of the week. I want to give out fair warning that some of the topics in this show will be, well, gross and not very pleasant. Returning guest Harry Hubbard is a researcher and collector of rare books and artifacts. We spoke with him in previous interviews about the ancient Egyptian repository in southern Illinois, and also on the many maps depicting Atlantis and the Bargos Islands at the North Pole. Harry Hubbard, welcome back to Another News.
Good to be with you, Jeff. Thank you.
This recent video that you posted, it took me a while to get through it. For the listeners, so they got a handle on this, what is the primary text that you reference in this research?
Encyclopedia Judaica. I guess pretty much exclusive on this particular presentation. That's all I'm doing is swimming through the pages of Encyclopedia Judaica and just pointing out what is written, what is actually in print concerning different topics, kind of surrounded the phrase practical Kabbalah, and that was my linear thread through the whole thing, is practical Kabbalah, which loosely translated means practical tradition. And, you know, as far as what practical means, you got me, honest tradition, dishonest tradition, who knows what they actually mean with that.
I transcribed what you presented on the screen of the definition of practical Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
It reads, the disciplines discussed in the preceding section, though they deal with practical instructions for spiritual life, do not belong to the realm of the practical Kabbalah in the Kabbalistic sense of the term, which refers rather to a different set of preoccupations. For the most part, the realm of practical Kabbalah is that of purely motivated or white magic, especially as practiced through the medium of sacred esoteric names of God and the angels, the manipulation of which may affect the physical, no less than the spiritual world. Such magical operations are not considered impossible in the Kabbalah or even categorically forbidden through numerous Kabbalistic writings. Do stress...
Well, there you have it. It's more of a huge word circle.
It is. And in the passage, especially as practiced through the medium of sacred esoteric names of God and the angels, the manipulation of which may affect the physical no less than the spiritual world. Now, that sentence there is very interesting because it connects back to a past guest, Cynthia Sue Larson, who talked about the title of it, her book is Reality Shifts, How Consciousness Changes the Physical World. And that's what they're talking about here. So it's an interesting parallel I just wanted to note for listeners who are familiar with the show and past guests. So moving along, primary text that you reference for this research in this video titled Swimming in Practical Kabbalah is the Encyclopedia Judaica. Can you tell listeners about the significance of this particular publication of the Encyclopedia Judaica?
Well, sure, Jeff. The Encyclopedia Judaica were first published, I believe, in the early 70s and then mid-70s and later 70s in Jerusalem, Israel. And it is pretty much the mouthpiece, the written, printed, published issue concerning Judaism. That's what you have to go on. And these sets of Judaicas are in a lot of university libraries and public libraries. And I guess a lot of people have them in their private libraries, too. I don't know where it stacks up with actually being one of the more popular, but it is very, very popular. It's right there. I'd say it's probably more popular than the Catholic Encyclopedia. It's probably right behind Britannica and some of the other encyclopedic, Funk and Wagnalls and some of the other encyclopedias. But there's everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism and the origins of so many things that people would never suspect would be printed in the Judaicas. I remember when I first got mine back in the early 90s or late 80s or so, my friends were just captivated with the subject matter and the topics that were listed in there. I mean, just on and on and on, just unbelievable what they would say about themselves and other people and, you know, in situations in general. Just unbelievable.
The books that make up the Kabbalah that are mentioned in the Encyclopedia Judaica include one called the Temana. Tell listeners what that is.
Well, it's just one. When I put this video together, I had to cut so many things out of it. I cut like 50 minutes after I had already cut five or six different topic lines, and then it was still like over 3 hours. I just kept cutting and cutting and cutting. But the Temana is one that I wanted to show concerning it, and then I go into another one called the Azalit. And the Temana, like so many other books concerning Kabbalah, it is what is known as a pseudepigraph or pseudepigrapha, meaning that, in essence, that it is a book created with an alternative meaning in mind, that it is a work of fiction, but we're going to promote it and treat it just as if it is a work of nonfiction. And we will refer to it, we will use it, and we'll just stick somebody else's name on it, or actually not have any name on it at all. A couple of good examples of a pseudepigrapha would be the Book of Enoch or the Book of Jasher. The term is actually created for these type of books, like the Book of Enoch. Enoch didn't write that. It's just a bunch of stuff that just popped up on the scene with an agenda. It's written with an agenda in mind.
Getting back to the Encyclopedia Judaica for a minute, can you tell listeners how many volumes that is and how many pages you had to go through to produce this video?
Well, the Encyclopedia Judaica is 16 volumes, and it comes with three yearbooks. And the yearbooks are updated and covers a lot of topics that aren't or that just were, for some reason, just left out of the main body text. And the Encyclopedia Judaica, when you open them up, you have four-page spread per page open. In other words, there's two columns on each page. When I was learning how to read fast, I chose this because the logical print of it is extremely intellectual. It's very, very well written. There's not that many typos in Encyclopedia Judaica. And the way the columns are made and the way the print is, the size of the print and the style of the print, I trained my eyes to be able to read and follow it quite fast. And I went through and probably read about another 2,500 pages to just put this together. And out of that, I axed a lot. I just kept axing things and axing. If it wasn't just totally relevant and interesting to me, I axed it, even though there was just so many side tangents to the whole thing. And there's plenty enough for others to pick up on their own research concerning that, and other people are doing that. The comments on the YouTube, other people are grabbing some of the topics I mentioned and running with it.
That's great. I just wanted listeners to get an idea of the volumes and pages that you had read and referenced and gone through to produce this. Okay, we went through the Tamina, basically covered that. There's another book called Azalit that
yes,
contributes.
Azalit.
Tell listeners about that.
Well, today you can pretty much just make it up as you go because none of the Azalits exist. I'm sure you could probably go online, and I still haven't done that. I don't know if they're available online or not, but it was all another pseudepigrapha written by one or two or several anonymous writers. And a lot of these books, the Tamina, the Azalit, same as with the Book of Zohar and the Talmud, they all have these commentaries all over the pages. It's like in the Talmud, for instance, you have the main body text in the center, and then you've got four commentaries all around it. Well, other books have those commentaries also. And, whether they're borrowed or created but from one guy or two guys or who knows. Nobody wants to fess up to it. So.
In your video, you point out the Azalit, the world of divine emanation, Beriah, the world, the throne, and the seven palaces, Yezira, the world of the divine chariot, Merkaba, and the ten angel choirs, and so on. It's very esoteric. And then you point out the word Azalit does not appear in Kabbalistic literature and is nowhere quoted, nor is any manuscript of it now in existence.
Right, right.
And if you do look online, you will find it. It's usually the title of somebody's musical recordings or albums.
They think it probably has to do with magic.
It might be so. It might be so. All right, moving along. Okay, that's one reference. Even though you reference it, and the qualifier is it doesn't appear in the literature, the Kabbalistic literature. So what's the value of it?
The value would be whatever somebody put on it. If it's referenced and everything, but it's not really there, but how do we know? How do we know it wasn't in a previous edition? I mean, it was supposed to be written, in the 12, 1300s or so? Like so many of these others, they just don't exist. Oh, but we have pathways and trails that lead to and from them. Well, you can just pretty much make it up as you go. I just threw those in there because the whole thing is quite confusing, and I do my best to kind of clear up the confusion.
Yes, I like that. You encourage people to follow up on this research. The next book is Zohar. Now, this gets really interesting.
yeah.
Book of Splendor, the central work in the literature of the Kabbalah. In some parts of the book, the Zohar is mentioned as the title of the work. It's also cited by Spanish Kabbalists under other names. And it's a collection of several books, five volumes, Utterance of the Tana, and a description of the gathering of Simeon Yohai and his companions, in which the most profound mysteries are expounded concerning the revelation of the divine in the form of Adam, primordial man.
Mm-hmm. And Yohai is just one guy that they give authorship to the Book of Zohar. And I used to have a single book of Zohar, then I had a two-volume set, and they were just fluff. They were, I think, printed in the 60s or so. You have to go back to the early 1800s and actually get them in Hebrew, or a real good translation from the mid-late 1800s to get a real good picture of it. And there again, it's just, a lot of mumbo-jumbo with commentaries and just all sorts of incantations and magic and this and that. people who really want to take this on, it's a big pain. There's a lot you have to learn. It's not like reading the Bible and you can, oh, okay, we have Jesus Christ, and you do this, you do that. Okay, you be a good person and you know, do this and do that. You know, no. With this mysticism, there's a lot of stuff that you have to do, and you have to do it just perfect, you know. If you're saying a prayer to God or Jesus or and you end up sneezing or coughing, no big deal. He can overlook that, and you can pick right up. Well, when you're talking to demons and stuff, man, no mumbling. You better enunciate it very cleanly, clearly. And if you cough or sneeze, you better, I'd say, to be on the safe side, you just need to start over again.
You know, that's interesting you say it, because a lot of Christians point out that God will see the intentions of your heart. And so it makes sense that if you're summoning demons, they need to hear the perfect incantation.
Yes, they do, yeah. And you better make sure that you know that you're acclimated to the proper language the demon that you're talking to. You don't want to be talking to a demon in German, for instance, who is expecting you to speak in like Polish or Latin or Spanish. You know, you want to make sure that it's a complicated issue.
Tell listeners about what you found in the Encyclopedia Judaica about alchemy.
Well, there's a whole lot more there than I show. And it's really unfair to say what I found, because there's so many pages and so many things and different attributes that I only just pick a couple of different things to mention. And it all has to do with incantations and the Philosopher's Stone and you know, people who did things way back in the past and such, and concerning alchemy. Even the guy that died, I'm sure he died of just sniffing lead, you know. And people trying to turn lead into gold, silver into gold, copper and lead into gold, on and on and on, and different things of that. And then there's what the one guy, he was writing, he says he was 1,025 years old. Well, how do we know? How do we know we're not, you know? But he was writing in Latin. I'll give him that. He wasn't writing in Hebrew or Arabic either, so where would he have come from in the first place? There was a lot concerning alchemy that I just pulled out, but there were, and the parts that I mentioned that I left in were absolutely essential. There was no way to leave that out to maintain my progression.
Some of the things that you mentioned in this production, alchemy and Kabbalah were closely linked in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
A Kabbalistic outline is found in the early alchemist manuscript of St. Mark in the 11th century called Solomon's Labyrinth. The wandering German alchemist Solomon Trismassen boasted that he drew his knowledge from Kabbalistic writings, which mm-hmm. had been translated into Arabic.
Yes, and there was evidently there were many Arabic and Islamic alchemists or Kabbalists or people who delved into the what we call today demonology, magic, etc., etc. And you know, another thing is my whole thing was to try to make this like an hour and a half to less than 2 hours long, and it ended up being, even with all the cuts, 2 hours and 12 minutes or something like that, which to me was long, but it clipped right along. It went from subject to subject. The presentation's got a pretty good flow to it, and you don't get lost in it. Even though we're swimming, it kind of gets really deep and thick at the end or towards the last probably one-fourth of the presentation. And I'm sorry that it ended up being over 2 hours. I was really trying to cut that down as much as I could. What I was left with was the bare bones.
In the alchemy aspect, there's a woman. Jewish personalities in alchemy. In the Egyptian-Greek period, one of the great alchemists was a woman known as Mary the Jewess.
Yes, that's what they say. I was unable to verify that. I don't know. I didn't move on it. But somebody else can move on that and come up with some things. I'm not so sure that's actually a fact. I know that she didn't invent hydrochloric acid.
Oh, really?
Which Judaica says she did.
Right. Oh, you know that. Okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but as far as I could see, on hydrochloric acid wasn't invented way back then. And, of course, her her brilliant statement. So, you know. But she had a couple of good one-liners and two-liners.
Okay. For listeners, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Do not touch the Philosopher's Stone with your hands, because you are not of our stock. You are not of Abraham's bosom.
Yeah, that was one of her finer moments.
What does that mean to you?
If she was experimenting with the Philosopher's Stone 2,000 years ago, and she said that, well, then who recorded it? She would not have been hanging out with any profanes or infidels at that time. They wouldn't be with her.
Are you implying that a profane or infidel wrote this?
I would say possibly, yeah. Why would she record in a paper something like that? I don't believe that she would have recorded it.
Okay.
If there's a lot of confusion.
There's a lot of contradiction, a lot of confusion, so the verb swimming is very applicable here.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I thank you. And that's just the YouTube title. The actual title of the presentation is Into the Maw of the Great Abyss. And that's what we do. We start swimming in practical Kabbalah, and then we go right down into the maw of the Great Abyss. And for your listeners that don't know what a maw is, that means the belly. We are swimming. We go down into the belly of the abyss, and that's where we're swimming. And you look at this, you look at that, and that's why I've got on my life preserver.
It's a great video. The next topic that you dive into is demons and demonology, and that's in the Zohar, I think. Basic definition, a demon is an evil spirit, or in the ordinary English usage of the term. This, the definition is, however, only approximate. In polytheistic religions, the line between gods and demons is a shifting one, and there are both good demons and gods who do evil. In monotheistic systems, evil spirits may be accepted as servants of the one God, so that demonology is bound up with angelology and theology proper, or they may be elevated to the ranks of opponents of God, in which case their status as diabolical powers differ from that of the demons in polytheism. Demons are the messengers of the Lord of the underworld and march before him. They live in deserts and near graves, and many of them are ghosts, spirits of the dead, especially those who died by violence or were not properly buried.
I thought it was interesting also that it mentions they also live in ruined buildings. And I thought of, like, ruined buildings or the dilapidated, obsolete buildings in certain towns, you know, in big cities, where the buildings have been gutted, and the gangbangers hang out in those buildings and such. And there's a lot of evil that goes on in these vacant buildings that are in crumbles and ruins. There's a lot of evil that goes on in there. And I just wondered, how much of today is that true still? And then also, like, the demons live in the deserts, you know, possibly ancient ruins as far as modern ruins, and at the bottoms of wells.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
The reference of Lilitu, the Mesopotamian succubus, is mentioned. Some listeners may know this entity as Lilith, that was Adam's first companion before Eve.
That's in folklore, yeah, it is. And that has been around for a long time. When I was putting this together, there's actually a Jewish woman that talks about Kabbalah. Oh, we're going to give you the secrets of Kabbalah. And this and that, which there's a lot of people online making videos about Kabbalah. And I saw enough of them to see when I was editing all this, just taking a break, and they don't give you any good information at all. Her whole take on it was like, it was just nonchalant and flippant concerning it. There's just nothing there. There's just nothing there. And I get a kick out of it, you know, the way people are trying to make it this or make it that. I guess none of these people ever had access or the desire to look up what it says in the Encyclopedia Judaica. They just never did.
Yeah, you really unearthed historic referenced information in these volumes, and that include the vampire.
Vampires and werewolves come out of the Judaica. Yep, they're all inventions, creations out of medieval Judaism.
Now, how old do you think this goes back in the Zohar and before that?
Probably 1400s, late 1300s, early 1400s or so.
This is getting into Jewish demonology. I noticed very interesting areas here in describing the detail. And for example, these demons have subtle bodies imperceptible by the human senses, and these subtle bodies allow them to fly through fire and air. And because they are composed of different elements, they come under the laws of creation and decay and die like human beings. Their sustenance is derived from water and fire, from odors and saps. Hence, necromancers burned incense to demons. Despite the element of subtle fire which they contain, they are surrounded by a coldness that frightens off the exorciser.
Well, probably the last 45 minutes of this presentation is pretty hardcore. And that's why I give a warning, you know, concerning, you know, hey, it's for mature adults. It's not for kids. They might actually have nightmares because of it. And all I'm doing is showing you the pages, reading it, and walking you through it. And it is pretty terrible, you know, especially when we start getting into human sacrifices, sacrificial infants, and certain things of that nature, especially when it comes to necromancy. And there's some pretty horrible, gross things in this presentation. I try to make fun of them and make them light and give a chuckle, which, in you know, I think in some places I did a pretty good job, but in other places I don't think I did as good a job as I could have. But it's hard to cover everything and get it perfect every time, and you have to just go with the flow on some of the takes.
I'm sure listeners are picking up on the contradictions here. Such as, well, why did you talk about these things if the text is not even valid? Referencing the Encyclopedia Judaica to begin with.
You have to show the doublespeak. If I only just showed one side, I think that would be unfair to my viewer. I think that showing the one side and the flip side in the same book is important. Because that way the viewer can start to get an idea of like, oh, well, let's just put this in here, let's put that in there, let's put this in here, and can start to see the word circles. And that's what I try to show is the word circles. And sometimes those word circles are there, and sometimes they are not. The actual truth is somewhere in between there. Does that make any sense?
It does, but I just wanted you to qualify it for the listeners. So you get into the sexual relations between demons and men, and
mm-hmm.
I think it was important to examine this. And as we mentioned earlier, Lilith earlier, a Talmudic legend stresses the origin of the demons in sexual intercourse between humans and demonic powers. Some demons, such as Lilith, were created during the 6 days of creation, and in particular on the Sabbath Eve at twilight, as disembodied spirits. They sought to take on the form of a body through association with humans, at first with Adam when he separated from Eve, and then with all his descendants. Now, that's interesting, because I thought Lilith was first, and then Eve came afterward after they had the argument, so I don't know. So the sexual element in the relationship of man and demons holds a prominent place in demonology of Zohar, as well as that of several later Kabbalistic works.
Mm-hmm.
And you pointed out this statement, every pollution of semen gives birth to demons. Now, what's going on there? What is that?
I guess it all depends on how someone defines pollution. But I do know that it seems to me that there's a lot of that going on today. And what actually do we end up being as far as a demon goes? Does a demon have to perform magic? I don't know. can a demon spirit be just walking around on the street, driving a car, riding a bike, riding a motorcycle? Possibly. It, you know, someone who has been polluted, that their, if their mind's been polluted, it can go several different ways. I do like the sentence, but as far as being able to comment on it or to make some kind of commentary on it, that's wide open. There it is in plain English. Anybody can run with that.
Well, in the later Kabbalah, it is pointed out that the demons born to man out of such unions are considered his illegitimate sons. They were called mischievous sons.
That's pretty interesting. I didn't know that, you know, but I showed it, you know, in there. I mean, I had seen it years ago when I put all this together, but like I say, this presentation, I could have done it years and years ago, but there was just no way how to put it together. And even like a year ago winter when I started making the scans, and I said, okay, I've got everything I want to cover scanned and in a folder. And after I had done a couple of videos about a month or so ago, 2 months ago or whatever, I wanted to bring it back out and just do it because I had all the scans, and then I started going through the scans, and then I had to redo some of the scans. And then I started culling and pulling stuff out. You know, and I pulled so much out. This presentation could have been easily 4 or 5 hours long. It could have been. But that's too long for a YouTube video. I don't have the capabilities to upload. So, and someone may notice that the quality on this particular video is not as sharp as some of my other stuff because I couldn't compress it and keep the quality. For some reason, I did it on a different computer, and it didn't work out quite as clear. But you can see everything. You can see everything just fine, so I left it. You know, sometimes we have to sacrifice, you know, certain things in order to gain in other places. So, and that's pretty much what happened with this video. It was just too long. It was like 5.5 gigs, and I have satellite upload.
I appreciate you distilling this down because I thought you did a really good job. To continue with the demons following certain people around, at death and burial, they come to accompany the dead man to lament him and claim their share of the inheritance.
I believe that that is still practiced today. Now, I do know that there are others that have the ceremonies of walking around the casket as it's being lowered into the ground in circles. Freemasons do that today, and I'm sure all the other little secret clubs that to put one of their own to rest eternally, that they do the same thing, walk around the casket in some kind of ceremonial pattern.
Yeah, as you said, this isn't very straightforward because there are comments such as, there are good-natured devils who are prepared to help and do favors to men. And then it gets into the book of Genesis. According to the legend, Cain and Abel, who contained some of the impurity of the serpent which had sexual relations with Eve, possess a certain demonic element, and various demons came from them. But in practice, the mating of female devils with human males and of male devils with female humans. This is interesting because I've heard people talk about this. Some believe that Cain was the product of Eve and the serpent. So Cain, you know, spelt in the various different ways, are of the serpent bloodline today. But they also include Abel in this as well.
Well, I can't remember the word for it. Something. There's a word for it. It's why they don't allow, for instance, super race horses to be bred with a horse that is of lower caliber, because some of that DNA stays in there, and I believe that that's what they're talking about, is you don't want that seed line corrupted at all if it's a horse. Humans, they don't care, you know. But anyway, there's some of that DNA will stay in there and be passed on, I believe, is what they're pointing to there. There's a fancy word for it. I forget that.
These devils are mortal, but they're kings and queens live longer than human beings, and some of them, particularly Lilith and Nama, will exist until the day of the last judgment. That's in the Zohar.
Yeah, I tell you, I'm looking at people's feet a little bit more closely too. Now, in the video that I'm working on now, on the opening page, you want to look at the feet. You want to look at the feet of the painting, and it's pretty bizarre. I'm just showing you what's in the book. I try to leave my opinions out of it because I think that my opinions could be tainted one way or the other.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm elaborating a little bit as a host, referencing some of the things that parallel information in this book and what I've read or heard from other researchers, including the kings and queens living longer, because some people think that the current queen is thousands of years old.
Hey, I remember the queen mother. Nobody thought she was ever going to die, you know? So.
And the crooked feet, Harry, you mentioned this in the video. You have a friend in Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell that story?
Well, he had emailed me, and he just came up, and he goes, hey, man, it was like a little parade or something. I don't know if I kept the emails or not. And it was last year, scanning for this stuff, and it just happened to be real fresh on my mind. So I sent him this that page there about the demons having crooked feet, and he like, whoa, that's heavy. He wasn't too fond of after I sent him that. He was pretty shocked by it all.
You come back again and again to the linear thread you point out of the practical Kabbalah,
mm-hmm.
And could you remind listeners why you do that?
Because at the very end, it's part of my punchline, and which I don't want to give away, but the whole issue of the practical Kabbalah just keeps popping up, popping up, popping up, popping up, again and again and again, and that's what I end with the subject of sorcery, and in magic, and divination, alchemy, demonology, Book of Zohar, practical Kabbalah is what swims through each one of these subject headings. And so that's what I used to tie it all together with. And especially when it comes to the title, Into the Maw of the Great Abyss, I borrowed that. I borrowed that right out of the book, you know. And it's hard to come up with names sometimes if it's something you really don't know what you're doing or what direction you want to end up with, but... And how in the world are you going to name it? So I started looking for, and it's the same thing with the video I'm doing now, which is probably going to go online this weekend, which is end of October, and I borrowed another title right out of the video itself, right out of what I came to put together.
Continuing with some of the work in the Zohar, that's the most intriguing information I thought so far, but because you have a lot of content and the content is very mystical, especially dealing with the underworld. And the references of the dragon is interesting as well, because it reads, the dragon is the name of the king of demons who is also mentioned in Sefer Hasidim. According mm-hmm. to Hayim Vital, four queens of the demons rule over Rome, that's Lilith, over Salamanca, that's mm-hmm. Agrith, over Egypt, Rahab, and over Damascus, Nama. That's interesting. So there's ruling demonic powers over assigned to different cities. Did you see any consistency with other research you've done with that material?
The presentation pretty much overall is horrible enough as it is without me making it worse. And that's pretty much what a lot of the stuff that I culled. Now, granted, in all through medieval times, the dragon was the bad guy. And then since, like I point out, since Walt Disney films, you know, they've made dragons household pets. So, and that's what we have today. You know, but now, where in the world these came from? Did some lizard-looking creature pop up out of smoke from a magic fire when they're throwing stuff in it or not? I don't know. But a lot of the scenes are pretty horrible. When you follow me on some of the issues that I point out, and your mind starts creating images of what this actually may be, it can go pretty bad. That's why I don't want, you know, children watching it, because as you start seeing some of this stuff, you go, ooh, yuck, or ooh, that's disgusting, ooh, that's disgusting. But I'm just showing it to you in the book. It's not like I'm just making up a horror story or mimicking some H.P. Lovecraft or Stephen King pseudepigraphical novel. You know, it's showing you the actual pages where all of this demonology, Kabbalah, Zohar, I'm showing the basic gist of the presentation is showing where it all comes from. when it comes to the divination, when it comes to all the folklore and superstitions, the realm of magic, the realm of sorcery, all this stuff that's inside this huge abyss, the great abyss. There's another guy on the net, what's his name, Trey Smith. He did one called Entities. Well, that's like, you know, that's not a bad name for something that I just did. It could be called Entities, but it's more about, you know, the origin of it all. And that's what I'm trying to point out with it, concerning Kabbalah, Zohar, Tamina, Azlitt, demonology, on and on and on, is showing where the origins are, where we can start at.
There are ways to defend yourself according to some of the material you present. There's ways to protect yourself from face-to-face encounters with demons.
Yes, I do point out some safeguards. Best thing to do is just stay away from it. And I think that as I watched it back and I was editing, I was thinking like, you know, somebody might think that I'm actually into this stuff. And really, I'm not, such as that I'm just a reader and I'm reporting. It's like a book report, but I would never have the time to do all of this, all these cleanses and spells and learning these chants in Hebrew and Latin and Greek and all this other stuff. I would never have time for it. Yeah, like I say, if you want to worship demons, it takes a lot of time. I guess you'd have to be a wealthy person and never had to go to work.
That could be the case, and it probably is for some. If you notice, a lot of the writers and individuals who are at the top of the heap discussing this material do come from wealthy families.
Yes, and a lot of it could be actually passed down from generation to generation. Who knows? I don't go there. I just point out that, you know, just to let everybody know that, no, I am not into any of this. I'm far more interested in other things. But like I say, I just had to figure that the time was right for me to put this together. And after my last couple of videos with the Quetzalcoatl and the flying books, I kind of said, well, let's do something a little more mystic. Let's go off the deep end and then start putting it together. But even as it sat in the computer, just in a file after file after file, I didn't know what to name it. And going back through, I would start bouncing around with some names and this and this. Same way with this video here. Now, the video I'm working on is actually the part one of this video. But I had to separate them. It was just too much. It was way too intense, way too many subject lines. But the video that we see is Into the Maw of the Great Abyss actually came out of the or was spawned in the video that I'm working on now, which will be out in just a few days. And it maybe not have young children in there with you. I mean, it can even gross out some adults. There's some stomach wrenches in there.
Some of the stomach wrenches include calling up the dead, washing dead bodies.
Oh yeah, that's we don't want to touch on that on the air, I hope. Cadaver juice. So, you know, but yeah, and some of this stuff I had to make up my own names. I've had to make up a lot of terms in my videos that are so shocking and out there that what do you do? So I have to make up something.
We won't go too much further into this. It does get very intense, you know, necromancy, calling up the dead, divination, and magic. I appreciate you putting this together. Very interesting, and it definitely could encourage people to follow up research on this.
That's what I'm hoping, is that people do start taking a notice of the Encyclopedia Judaica in their local libraries and just open one up and start your own thread. There's so much to learn in there. And I start my research there and I end it there, no matter really where it's going to go. And there's so much good information there. I love the books. I really do. I do.
In the video, the short video that you produced titled Flying Books, mm-hmm. I want to talk about that for a second because
okay.
I thought it dovetailed into the work of the guest we've had on, Cynthia Sue Larson, who wrote the book Reality Shifts When Consciousness Changes the Physical World. And she's talking about actual print is and content of a book actually go missing. The pages are there, the content is gone. And in the Flying Books video, something similar happened to you. Would you be able to summarize some of that for the listener?
Well, first of all, I want to just tell you that when I was making that that video, I had no idea. I had never heard of the Mandela effect. I had never heard of it. But there's other things, news captions that come out that you think like, wow, I thought I heard that last week. Or I thought I heard that. I thought that already happened. That event happened. So even given that, and it was about the print in one of my books printed, 1831 or 35, 34, something like that. When I went back in to try to find a story, there was something else there. The story wasn't there. And how else would I have ever even known about the story? That's the kicker, is how would I even known about it, because I have never seen it printed in any other book. And same thing with the laughing disease. I would have never known anything about it had I not read it in this book published in, 1945.
Did you make notes?
Not in the Amazon book, no. And that's a book called The Rivers Ran East. Very fascinating book, filled with high adventure. But I would have never known anything about it. I'd never heard. You don't type in to Google unless you hear it from somebody, the laughing disease, where people just die of exhaustion from laughing. They're to their last breath, they're just laughing at full throttle.
The text that you thought was there wasn't there.
Correct. And that's in two of the books that I had, yeah. One of them I had explicit notes on, the other one I did not.
Harry, could you also tell listeners about flying books?
A flying book is a phenomena that's happened to me 4 times, and at least 4 times. And I had met Eustace Mullins, who said it had happened to him. And I'm sure that there are other antiquarian book dealers, booksellers, in some of the bigger cities like New York and Chicago, Boston, etc., that have actually experienced books that flew off the shelf. It must happen to older books. Now what I'm seeing online is that it's happening in newer books as well. But I don't know. I just know the cases that I can point out explicitly and clearly of where it has happened, as far as I'm concerned, to me in my life. But it's a phenomena, and you have to move with the flow. Maybe there are some good spirits that are trying to tell you something, or something genetic, or something that your mind triggers in the ethers that causes these books to just fly off the shelf. And it happened. And when I explained to Eustace Mullins what had happened, he told me he set me right on it. He set me right on it. And I learned so much from that guy. He just absolutely brilliant. Before he passed away. And that was back in the early 90s when I met him and got to spend a lot of time with him. But I'm sure that anybody goes into an antiquarian book dealer, I would just make an inquiry. Say, hey, man, do any of these books just happen to fall off the shelf for no reason? If you got some older guy there that's been dealing antiquarian books all his life, it doesn't hurt to ask. It doesn't hurt to ask at all. They may look at you like you're crazy, and they may not even want to tell you, what book was it? Because now, if it ever happens to me again, I would certainly, make note of the book, especially if it was the same book twice. My goodness, how much more obvious can it be?
Harry Hubbard, it's always fascinating to have you on the show to talk about the work that you're producing and putting out online, and referencing your vast storehouse of collectible books and maps and artifacts. Thank you again for being on In Other News. Would you tell listeners how to find your YouTube channel and website?
Google me. I live in a glass house. The Harry Hubbard YouTube channel. I've got several other websites. There's IllinoisCaves.com, which is one of my main subjects. You can purchase books and some other stuff from alexanderhelios.com. But there's I touch on a lot of different subjects. I'm not stuck into one quagmire. I swim around in several different puddles of mud and trying to make sense of it all. And I'm trying with my YouTube channel to keep the level of intellect on the Internet at its highest point. In other words, I think that people who are really, really smart, intelligent, and looking for things that tickle their brain, they're going to come back. They're going to find something else that they can gravitate to. And you really do have to have an extended attention span to follow along with some of my subject matter. And I want to thank you also for having me on a Halloween night. I would have never thought that I'd ever put out a horror show. But, I guess I did that beyond. I did better than I thought I would have, that's for sure.
Oh, indeed. Well, thank you again, Harry, for being on In Other News.
And thank you, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information.
The same building at more or less the same time, and they were all free, and they were all asking themselves the same question: what is behind that curtain? born. And so you're free. So happy birthday.